You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now, Marty Gibson, for another round of Media Matters this week. How are you, Marty?
I'm good, thanks. I'm really good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. The Olympics are over, which I'm kind of relieved about. So it's all done and dusted. And well done to all of the New Zealand team. Pretty fair Olympics by all of them. So that's great news. Well done, all of you. I have to admit, I have hardly watched a thing.
This isn't a sports show, though, is it, Marie?
No, it's not a sports show. I do sort of track the X. I came across a post from Anthony Albanese. I thought, and I had to check, I thought it was a satire account. He was congratulating Reagan for their great performance at the Olympics, which I watched the highlights of. Let's just say I don't think Australia is going to be breaking any breakdance records anytime soon.
Well, didn't Lydia Ko do well? And something that was, it's not a good confession to make as you're doing a media show, but my media consumption hasn't been exhaustive this week. But I didn't see any note about the message that Lydia Ko got from Donald Trump congratulating him. I only saw that on X, and it wasn't in the New Zealand media anywhere.
Yeah, I was delighted for her. You know, she's now got the full set.
Yeah. What it is about Lydia Ko, she's just an appealing person, isn't she?
Do you know what I think it is about Lydia Ko? Is that she is so hardworking and diligent. And here is a young woman who's, I mean, she burst into our consciousness as a teenager. She, to me, if you need to sort of peg out a role model, right, for young women in New Zealand, I think Lydia Ko is somebody that you can say, look at this young woman. She reached the heights of success at a very young age. Then things came crashing down for her psychologically. She then picked herself up, worked twice as hard, got out there, made changes in her life, and she's now back at the pinnacle again. It's like the Chumbawamba song, isn't it? You get knocked down, get yourself back up again. That, to me, is something that we don't, I think, pay enough respect to.
I mean, New Zealand's always had trouble acknowledging our Kiwis of Asian origin. You know, not trouble, but, you know, the Bik Runga kind of thing. You never heard much about her being Māori because, I don't know, she wasn't really described that way and enjoyed considerable success. Motorsports people as well are the other people who don't get a lot. But, no, great. What I saw of the Olympic success looked successful.
No, so that's all done and dusted. And, you know, as we've mentioned the last few weeks, there's been lots of bread and circuses. The bread style, the circus is shit. And again, that theme is sort of kind of rocketing along with many of the things that the media have chosen to focus on across the week. Some things they've gotten right and some things they've gotten so very wrong.
Well, I mean, if you're charitable enough, and you are always a lot more charitable than I am in this, if you're charitable enough to conclude that it's just a matter of accident rather than consciously. Someone put this quote on the Olympic closing ceremony, which had, of course, its one-armed, one-winged angel rising, observed by some golden bird of some sort and some arcane occult ceremony. Someone posted it with the George Orwell quote, "Power is tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing." Mm. That was quite an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, indeed.
I don't think it's accidental. I mean, you know, and that's the problem with X, and that's the divide that's arising between people who use X and people who don't. You know, the people who are most likely to consume and believe the mainstream media are female Labour Party voters, closely followed by National Party voters of both sexes. Mm. All of those will be baby boomers, so, you know, there's a coming correction. It's quite a jarring difference, isn't it, between seeing all of those black-clad, masked Islamists waving machetes around, and then, you know, the joyful narrative of all of these pencil-neck leftist anti-fascists outnumbering these terrible thugs.
Well, this is the thing. You've got the riots in Britain, as this is where we've juxtaposed to. The riots in Britain, as I said last week, there have been thuggery going on? Probably. Hello, it's a riot and a, you know, protest.
Some people like riots. They bit of football hooliganism as well. Yep. I like Venn diagrams.
But again, it's the same as BLM. The whole narrative and painting of it, if I hadn't looked on X to see both protests from both sides, and they're now calling these black-clad Islamist protests the counter-protesters, which are stepping in to protect mosques or what have you from these far-right rioters. And I'm thinking, right, so these are the same black-clad machete-wielding protesters that have been just swamping streets in Great Britain since October. And even before that, you know, in places like, I mean, Rotherham, you know, with these grooming gangs and hundreds of women being raped and groomed and sexually abused, but heaven forbid, you know.
They were children.
Children, Well, yes, underage children. And police doing nothing about it because they don't want to create social and racial unrest. I can see why the frustration has bubbled up to this point.
Well, you were saying that you thought that they were the same as the Black Lives Matter protests. I was thinking, well, they are the same as in that they're both sponsored by George Soros. And, you know, those signs that they were waving around looked very slick. All the protesters simultaneously had the same signs with the same sized wood holding them up. And, you know, there's a lot of links between, what does it say, no to racism, and the Labour Party and British Union. So it's a far-left organisation. It's conveniently come through to give Keir Starmer a talking point that, you know, these people who are objecting to very objectionable, never-voted-for immigration policies that's having real effects on people. One of the bad things about X is that you do see people getting children getting the crap beaten out of them by big gangs of immigrants in Germany and in the UK. There are real consequences for people that they have very legitimate complaints about. So to see them characterized as this, and it's quite shocking that Keir Starmer, one of his first acts was to let people out of prison, and then with the next in the next breath, he's putting people in prison for political crimes, letting out criminals.
So this is something you touched on briefly last week, and I want to get your thoughts on it this week. When you have a population, like many Western populations, but especially the British, who have been continually gaslit now for years about the social makeup of their country and what is actually going on and what they can actually see going on, you finally have a trigger point with the three girls that were murdered. You have this flashpoint. It's created all of these riots. As you say, is this a flashpoint that has been manufactured to happen, or has this been a case of let's not allow a crisis to go to waste and we use said crisis in order to clamp down on things and groups that we want to clamp down on, and especially in terms of censorship and what people can say and news? We didn't quite get there with the corona crisis, but let's do it with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, when you're in a bar fight and you dodge a punch, you don't want to pat yourself on the back for too long because there's another one coming from somewhere else. Someone's going to chuck a chair. What I see looking at all of this is you've got an unholy alliance between Islamism, which has as its ultimate goal global caliphate. We've got a media that has a fawning response to that, where they're afraid to criticize Islam because they don't want their buildings burned down and they don't want their journalists murdered. Whereas they know if they crack down on protesters against said illegal immigrants and, you know, legal migrants in a lot of cases, they're not going to get burned out to the same extent. But what you're seeing the burning start. And then, you know, on top of that, it comes down to that rule of politics that I bang on about ad nauseum. Governments love anything that makes people demand less freedom and more government. Mm. And radical Islam fits that bill. So we're seeing that in motion with Keir Starmer. It suits him just fine. Let's take away freedom. And you're going to need more government to spread all of these people throughout the country. That's what he's saying he's doing. He's going to move them into communities throughout the UK. So, yeah, we're seeing this deliberate process of it's a great replacement. And they are being British and European people, you know, for decades haven't been breeding in sufficient numbers to replace themselves. The answer was to encourage them to have more kids, but you've got all these kids being told the world's about to boil in 10 years, so they're not.
It will be interesting to see whether British people find a sort of Churchillian-type courage to push back on this, because that's the other side of it with immigration. I mean, the British, they've always had immigration, but that immigration was often come from empire, if you know what I mean, like from the transition from empire to Commonwealth. So therefore, you sort of were still under that banner, that cultural banner of the British monarchy, whereas this is a completely different beast. Simon O'Connor on Friday, actually, in his show, did a great interview with Sunil Sharma from the UK, and he had a really interesting take in terms of that, you know, a big difference in of that unchecked immigration from large groups of people that have no interest in British life.
And see themselves as superior to it. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of those women who were raped and were tortured had a very similar story. They were called a name which I think in Urdu, which is what Pakistani people speak, means white slag. But it was never seen as a hate crime. The hate crimes aren't for that.
So then you sort of turn things topsy-turvy on their head and we have a look at things closer to home. Race relations in this country are certainly still bubbling along. And you have pointed out a lot of similarities between the organisation and mindset, the Islamist mindset over there versus the mindset.
Radical Māori, yeah.
Radical Māori mindset.
And, I mean, you can draw all sorts of parallels with that. I mean, whether, you know, you want to start with they're both raiding cultures that value violence and intimidation. They're boasting about outbreeding other populations, which is something you hear from Iwi leaders sometimes. You can draw quite a list there. But just zooming out again, my feeling about it is that the people who are using, whether they're Māori radicals or, you know, people with ethno-nationalist ideals or radical Islam, they basically take the most retrograde bits of it. Because there is some beauty in Islam and there's beauty in Māori culture. But that's not necessarily what they're using. They're using the will to dominate, the will to the jealousy, the sacred anger, the overreaction to any insult. They're mixing it up with the neo-Marxist ideals that somehow they're morally right because historically they might have had a rough time. I always caution, say to Māori, you know, women thought the Rockefellers and the CIA were doing them a big favor in the 60s and 70s and uplifting them by sponsoring feminism, but what they were sponsoring was division and demoralization of their most likely opponents and more power for themselves. And now those same psychopaths are really concerned about indigenous this and that for the same reason, division and demoralization of their most likely opponents. If you want to make New Zealand a client state, you tell most of the people here that they're not here legitimately and it's not their country.
Well, also too with Māori is I see Māori have been commoditized. They have been turned into a product that is either made benefit by other Māori, elite Māori. They have been weaponized to an end, and I just find that quite repugnant, actually. And I feel that self-agency, that strength, that courage, that mana has been stripped away from them. And they don't realize that it's gone. They don't realize that they have, because they, if you don't pay for something, you become the product. We've said this many times. Yeah. But then when you've got something that has gone from being a privilege to a right, then when it's taken away or anything changes around that, you believe your rights have been taken away when actually it's not a right at all. It's a privilege. And we've got now this with the whole benefit crackdown and what's been happening and in that too. And I think we want to, let's go head into the direction of this whole social investment. Well,
just before we do that, the other similarity between the situation with Islam and the situation with Māori is you've got a fawning press and fawning politicians. I've mostly finished a column on fawning, because I think it really cuts to the heart of the matter. It's the fawning response is a response to stress and which you try and ingratiate yourself to your oppressor and try and be more like them, to be more pleasing to them. And so, you know, Māori are primarily dealing with people who are fawning to them. And the natural response of that, someone who's behaving like a bully to someone who's fawning, is to just have less respect for them. And that's not the path to peace. That's not the path to coming to terms. It's the path to being tyrannized. And the stress is coming because you've got most people who are like, well, that's not my response. And you can't characterize. And it's like the media and politicians are the oldest sibling who's fawning to an abusive parent who's beating the younger kids so they don't misbehave in a way that's going to set off the abusive parent. That's why it's so vital. And, you know, I'd like to see us do more of what we're doing now, and with Lee as well. He's absolutely on the right track with what he's doing. Some of the things he's saying, you know, like, oh, Māori want co-governance. How many Pākehā are on your marae committees? Do you really want it that bad, or do you want to dominate things because it's not the same?
No. That whole sort of element around social investment, and also the fact that they have become a commodity and they've been fed essentially Marxism, but with a Māori flavour to
putting the mayo into Māori.
Well, this is just it. And it's this whole myth of social utopia. All social utopia is Marxism dressed. It's the wolf in sheep's clothing.
The social investment thing, I and you know, you mentioned that briefly. We looked at Matthew Hooton's article on that. And I've been really interested in the social investment proposition. I think that's the path forward. But in order to get there, you've got to lose the Marxist drive for equity, because you've got to find what makes some people do better than others. And you've got to try different things with different people. So that goes against the centralization drive of the neo-feudalists and the WEF and the little puppets like Hipkins and Ardern.
Yeah, so the Hooton opinion piece, Matthew Hooton, and social investment, just do it now. What stood out for you right from the get-go? You were the one that flicked to me.
Well, just that the idea's been on the blocks waiting for the starting gun he said he first wrote a column about social investment in 2010, and he makes the salient point that if in 2011, when Prime Minister Bill English was advocating for social investment, and as were Ardern and Hipkins, he said that if they'd implemented it, then a lot of the kids who could have helped would have been in gainful employment and education their second year at university rather than in jail. That dilly-dallying has had real-world consequences. Government agencies, so he's basically saying it's just an algorithm. It's just a better way to target services. It's going to be messy, but it can't possibly be worse than the status quo, where taxpayers' money keeps going to organizations and programs that have failed but are politically powerful among the Wellington bureaucracy or are popular with party donors.
Well, and with that too, it's looking at these algorithms in terms of, like, dare I say it, wanting outcomes from investment, that there is going to be a lot of wah-wah, because there are a lot of agencies, Wairarapa Trust, who have made millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. Government
and can inevitably point to something good that they've done. So, well, this is what we've done. Well, yeah. if you gave me $200 million, I could have some good stories to tell you and still a whole heap in my back pocket and a really nice house like John.
I mean, I do applaud the fact that the government wants to actually look at outcomes. They want to then siphon that money to places where they're going to see outcomes. And I think we talked about this months
ago. We've talked about it the whole time we've been doing the show.
We have, you know, and I've seen, you know, I know people involved with Salvation Army, and I've seen where programs have been cut there around poverty and addiction services, that programs that were working to go to other programs that have a better headline for media and a more politically palatable. Yeah.
What I'd like to see is I'd like to see community organizations having access to a centralized accounting system, because there are a lot of people on boards who are looking over spreadsheets who've got no clue at how to read them. And there's a lot of inefficiency just in terms of applying for funding. The government should get a good idea. I call it the trellis system. They should get a good idea of what needs to happen and then look at where the niches are on that, tender for them, and people apply for them. And, you know, it's at a set rate that maybe is negotiable. Time goes on, but there's a bit of management there already. So you're not reinventing the wheel the whole time. And, yeah, try different things. Have a certain amount of centralized intellectual horsepower behind it in terms of what things we might try, but try different things in different places. And I think what National really need to do as well is unlock the latent energy that's within just ordinary law-abiding, productive New Zealanders to mentor people. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can, and again, that would come with a system to prevent abuse. But if you could have a functional family mentor a dysfunctional family, and, you know, get some reward if they do better, it'll be interesting to see what you might achieve with that. And I'm looking at taking on a few projects myself to that end. And it's easy enough to do, because often people don't get any encouragement.
And also too, the place that used to happen was generally within a faith-based environment. So correct. you would have, you know, people coming together to worship, some families needing a little bit more help or support or fellowship.
And being treated by people, by their neighbours as they would like to be treated.
Exactly. And of course, again, I mean, I like to call myself faith adjacent. I don't hold faith, but this is where I see, this is the God-shaped hole that's been left in our societies, because that's been taken away. So that mechanism that happened organically for decades has now gone. And I think you're right. I think self-agency, communities need to take this back. So if you can't take that back within an environment of faith, where do you take it back? Do you take it back? I mean, where is it in a sporting environment or community, or where?
Schools would be a logical place to do it. And, you know, that's another place that I'm scratching my head and thinking about projects, you know, particularly, and I had a try at this and hit a wall in the past with my younger kids' primary school, but I'll have another go at it. I think if you can get fathers together and doing little projects, then that's good for kids and good for the community.
Because I know with schools, one of the trouble now is that, like, again, back in the day, this is one of the differences that I'm seeing, is that I was really heavily involved with the primary school when our boys were there. Part of the reason for that is that I had a kid that had a high level of needs. He wasn't always the best member of the school community, let's put it this way, because of the needs that he had. And the support coming from outside of the school, i.e. the Ministry of Education, was pretty much nada. So we had to, as a parent, I needed to go in and give as much of my time and support I could muster whilst working full time in order to support the school, to help support my son. Sometimes there was really great results. Sometimes it was a little bit more difficult, but it all came down to the fact that there was a need there, and me as a parent was the only one that could fulfill it. That's the difficulty. I think a lot of parents are pressed with work, but also a lot of parents are not prepared to make the time either. They see the 9-to-3 babysitting service as something
I mean, it used to be that a man digging ditches could support a wife at home and four kids and still go to the pub four nights a week and get drunk. You know, we've been squeezed. And really, we should be working a 10-hour week by now. If you look at the efficiencies of continued industrialization, things have got worse. And where the squeeze has come from is the people who print the money, wanting more and more flesh.
Hmm. So these benefit sanctions that Louise Upston is looking at introducing, there's a traffic light system, which of course triggers me straight away, but I don't know about you. There's this traffic light system. They're looking at and non-compliance. And to be brutally honest with you, I think there's probably only a very small percentage that are quite recidivist in the sense that they don't want to get up and go and work. And I also think a percentage of those people as well fall into the mental health camp, but because of the state of services, they're not categorised correctly within the system. So I think there's a lot of that going on.
And there's a lot of people who aren't maybe categorised as having, for example, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, who are just a bit sawn off. One of the effects of enthusiastically pushing abortion is it does take your eye off the need for neonatal care and preconception care as well, ensuring that, you know, people are getting together in a stable way and before they think about having kids.
Hmm.
So we're not producing right from the get-go. Sometimes the raw material we're dealing with in people could be better.
So Upston said our welfare system will always be the safety net that catches people if they fall. But in the past few years, it has become a dragnet that has captured too many people who can work and allowed them to languish on JobSeeker support for too long. The number of people on JobSeeker support increased by 70,000 under the previous government as the use of sanctions significantly decreased, and almost two-thirds of the people receiving this benefit have been on it for over a year. Our government will not tolerate people who accept the job seeker benefit but refuse to uphold their obligation to seek a job. It's just not fair on hardworking Kiwis who pay their taxes and go towards those benefit payments. We will continue supporting those who permanently or temporarily cannot work, but our expectation will be that those who can work should be taking reasonable steps to find a job, and those who don't will face consequences.
Can't get out of their own way in their messaging, can they? And you can just sort of hear that maybe they've played this past various blue rinse white folks who make up the National Party, and that, those layabouts. And it's kind of like, okay, that makes you look uncaring, and it's not motivating. A much better way to message that, as I just keep saying, is, hey, it sucks being unemployed. It's not good for your health, mentally or physically. It's not good for your family. It's not good for New Zealand. If you can get into work, it's going to be tough at first because it's like trying to get fit when you're unfit. But after, say, 3 months of just forming a steady habit of getting out of bed and going to work, you'll feel so much more regard for yourself. And your family will look up to you. And you'll find that after a year of doing that, where you really make a decision that you deserve better in life, your whole life will be better. You won't recognize yourself. Now get to it. That's the way they should message it.
So again, it's finding those programs, isn't it, with those NGOs. When you've got kids, especially, and we're seeing that now with my son's friend groups, because a couple of these kids have now fallen off the school wagon. They haven't gone the full distance. They have left school. And one of them, he has been sort of in and out, and he's now on training and trades. And he spent actually some time working in a plastering gang, going to houses and plastering. And he just loved it. You know, as that sense of purpose.
It's awesome. If you haven't been working for a while, just doing a good, and you could do that. So it was almost theatre. You could say, all right, this first week, man, you're going to enjoy this. It's just where you're sort of getting back into it. So we'll come around, pick you up, might bring you a bit of Kai, and we'll sit down and have a cup of coffee, and maybe we'll even bring a couple of people, and we'll give your house a bit of it, help you tidy up a bit, and then take you around. You can meet a few people, have a bit of a go, and then send you home with some food and a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
Just so your first week of going back to work is just awesome. And you could find missions as well. There's plenty of missions that New Zealand needs doing. We could be harvesting biomass to make sustainable aviation fuel. using the forestry slash. You know, we could be replanting rivers. We should have systems to look at. And I think if we went into debt to do that as a nation, so we were paying people to do that sort of work, it would be debt that I'd feel a bit happier with, because God knows we haven't got a lot for squealers billions.
No.
I can't look out and see a beautiful a planted stream or, energy security for that matter.
Mm.
The opposite.
And the difficulty is just getting these kids motivated. You know, getting them motivated, getting them up off the couch, awake, and as you said, sort of out the door. I would hope that some of these programs, if they are, because they talked about using algorithms, and if they're starting to look at programs where you have, like, I'd love to see, was it the student army that after the Christchurch earthquake that went out and pulled students together to actually help with the Christchurch rebuild? Something like that, where you can get young people out, pull them together, help rebuild or
have
do
a good
something.
Time.
Yeah.
Have a good time, be part of a team, be a bit competitive. There were people up the coast, I remember, who were really nostalgic for the good old days. Were a couple of stalwarts, old, probably ex-Māori battalion guys, would drive around in a truck, and if they saw young people just sort of loitering around, they'd just say, hey, boy, come and jump in the truck. We'd go, and they were planting willow poles, which are now washing up the beach in slash, but, you know, it was part of the fight against erosion. Yeah, if you can find local missions, have it work that's got some meaning. I think the thing that's missing often, and there's a point that I've made multiple times, Luxon's not a good salesman. He's a terrible salesman. I can imagine him being one of those salesmen, you know, when you start selling and you just give people brochures and you just sort of, you know, try and get them to like you, and you think if they like you, they'll buy something off you. Getting people moving like that, it's a sales job. And it's what I said before, hey, man, this is going to be a changing time for you. You're going to love this.
Hmm. And it needs to be on projects that are sort of based in and around infrastructure or the like, that then gives these young people skills that then become transferable out in the wider world and community in the private sector. Because the difficulty now, I don't know the feeling that you're getting, but the feeling I'm getting over the last week or so here in this country is we are now further slipping out of first world status into second world status when you look at not only the state of the healthcare system overall, and we won't dive there just yet, but this entire power crisis now is, you know, we've had a large business here in Hawke's Bay, Panpac, is now shuttered. They've just spent $330 million to get that plant up and running after Cyclone Gabrielle, only to shutter it because the spot power prices are so high that they can't afford to run it.
And that's, I saw in the business section, that's 30% of the business going through the Napier port. And they supply wood chip to a whole lot of businesses up and down the east coast of the North Island. And these businesses don't have more than a month's supply of wood chip. It's going to have a cascading effect. Like a family that's been living on credit cards to look richer than we are. Not only we've got to pay the credit cards back, and we still don't have the money, and we're used to that living standard. So it's a triple whammy.
Panpac too, of course, is sitting, and this is the great thing, it sits at the foot of the Ranges with the brand new wind farm above it, which is
mocking it
pretty much, and
a
geothermal power station, which I think hasn't been, I don't know whether that's operational again after Gabrielle, right next door. Even the industry and the business that I'm in, you know, the manufacturing side of that, we're having struggles. You know, we are both high users of power and natural gas. And those prices are just insanely high.
Yeah. It comes from a generation of people who are not terribly numerate and have been swallowing of an agenda to hobble humanity by reducing energy consumption and ultimately population. That's a bit that no one's that quite keen on chatting about. Brian Leyland, I rate him. He wrote an article. This was back in May, but it's very pertinent to a current problem, because Brian Leyland knows this complex issue better than any other New Zealander, in my estimation. So he lays out the mistakes which were establishing a trading market, short-term energy, and the belief that electricity is a commodity like any other. It isn't. It's the lifeblood of the old economy, and there is no alternative. So they believed the market would provide an economic and reliable supply, but it has produced expensive and unreliable electricity. So, yeah, it's really worth a read. He says, what options does the new government have? End the ban on oil and gas exploration, do whatever is necessary to induce the drillers to come back. Now, Heather Duplessis-Allen made a good point about that, she, that when Labor's saying, hey, whatever these guys do, we're just going to reverse it, that's kind of economic treason. Require wind and solar developers to contribute to the cost of providing the backup needed to keep the lights on when they're not producing. Investigate emissions-free and reliable nuclear power. The widely held belief that nuclear power is dangerous is not supported by evidence. It is 100 times less dangerous than hydropower from large dams. Provide the aluminium smelter with a long-term contract on condition that it made a major contribution to managing peak demands and reducing energy demand during a dry year. Modernize hot water control using smart thermostats. Set up a comprehensive independent review of the electricity market. Investigate the proposition that it is better to stop squandering money on futile efforts to change the world's climate and instead concentrate on defending ourselves against an ever-changing climate visits on upon us. Now, I've cobbled bits from that. As I said, it's worth going to Muriel Newman's excellent site and looking that up.
We spoke to, you know, an electrical engineer, and we got to know him because he was actually the one travelling down here to get Panpack up and running, as well as did a lot of the work on the substation post-Gabrielle. We talked about, and this is months ago, right, months ago, we were talking about the strain on the grid and power in New Zealand and how things like winding back of Tiwai in order to release power and have more there. And I said to him, nuclear. I said, would that make a difference having a nuclear power plant? And he said, no, you need two.
Mm.
He said, you have one in the North Island and one in the South. Because wherever I've gone to in the world, they have set up a nuclear power station. That ready, available and cheap power, he said, is a very addictive thing. But in order to do it safely and effectively, you do need to take them offline at intervals for servicing and maintenance and upgrades and all of those sorts of things. So you need to build two. So then that way you have a contingency built in place. So you're able to do that. And you have that as an adjunct to infrastructure that you already have. And then when you've got that, you've got the ability to have cheap and ready power. And many of these things that we have in terms of when you look at things like the poverty and all those other issues, imagine if you were able to reduce people's power bills significantly, the cost of goods and delivering of those goods significantly, all of the things around the power generation and fuel in order to get from point A to point B. If you stripped a huge amount of that cost out, that will be the rising tide that will lift so many of those boats. And yet, ideologically, no, we can't do that because of, you know, climate or whatever the ideological du jour is of the day. And it's frustrating. So I think New Zealand needs to get over its big bad 1980s self, and we need to grow up, and we potentially need to at least have the discussion that it's time to actually look at alternatives. Because if we're growing, the New Zealand of 3 million people in 1984 is not the New Zealand of 5.5 million people in 2024.
Well, I mean, again, that's assuming that the fat controllers do want to see a thriving, prosperous group of people.
I'm being optimistic, Martin.
Yeah, well, you know, we go back to James Shaw's first letter to the Climate Commission, where he said the big barriers to New Zealand achieving its climate goals were population growth and economic growth. And 6 years on from that, the birth rate had decreased, live birth rate had decreased by 28%, and the economic growth was second to last in the world after Equatorial Guinea. By that measure, what he wanted to do was great success, and I just don't think it's something you can sell. So they just do it, and that's what we're experiencing now. It's not... Mm.
So do you think the coalition government has the appetite to turn this around? Because from what I've seen from Christopher Luxon, he is drinking the climate Kool-Aid just as much as James Shaw or any of the others were.
Yeah, maybe worse. I think we have to ride this all the way down, quite honestly, because we've just got too many things that have jammed the controls. The media is not helping. Politicians are following the media. The media, as I've said before, you know, people might just be waking up a little bit now to the fact that they're not the customer of media, the product mix. The real customers are the Satanists who own the ultimately own the advertisers. And so what's in the paper is what they want in the paper.
It's interesting you say ride this all the way down. I've just spoken to Natalie Cutler-Welsh, and the one thing she talks about is the breakdown before the breakthrough. She's very much with you on this. Things have got to break down in order for us to break through. And you do wonder when you see these businesses, shutting their doors because you can't even supply the most fundamental consumer resource to them and power that you would expect in a first world nation. Surely people have got to wake up.
It's going to be an interesting year. And by interesting, I mean terrifying potentially. You know, the Ministry of Energy in the States has done a study that if the US power grid went down for 9 months, 90% of the population would die. So, you know, the fact that they're doing those studies is a bit unsettling. You know, we're very vulnerable in the state that we've allowed ourselves to become. I see all these tweets and I think, man, we must be getting close to peak. Weak men make tough times. But yeah, we're about to have the tough times that make the strong men, so, and strong women.
Indeed we are. What else did you get? I saw the congestion charges. That's creating a little bit of a ruction, particularly for those north of the Bombays. And there was actually, I think, a potential that they may even consider them in your neck of the woods. Do you think Mahi will go there?
Yes.
Right, not a lot of thought there.
No, I mean, he's an inside guy and they're really short of money, and Tolly's been running up a fair bit of debt, you know, doing a lot of work that no one really wanted in terms of traffic control and things like that. So, yeah, I think there'll be some architect's picture of a thriving city with pedestrians and no cars. I mean, it's what they did in the UK. This is a global fetish. So, yeah, we'll get congestion charges. They're not making the cycle lanes for people who want to cycle. They're making them ahead of giving us no choice but to cycle.
I just couldn't get my head around when, you know, you've got the likes of Simeon Brown, actually both of the Browns, Simeon and Wayne, sort of saying that this is going to be a good thing and this will help bring down the cost of transport and people won't be stuck in traffic jams and it will help get things moved around the city and the like. But it will surely that will just exacerbate costs even further because you've got to now pay these congestion charges for those that don't have a choice to go into the city. I mean, you know, trucks, deliveries, couriers, all those people that need to do that. And surely if you're putting barriers up to stop people going into the central city on it from a congestion point of view, all you're going to be doing is killing your inner cities. Oh, God, I hope Wellington do it.
I was in Auckland over the weekend, and, man, that place is a dog's breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, RCR Bites, I was reading The Bites this morning, and the author of The Bites did put a footnote in the story about the congestion charges. And maybe we'll look at the migration settings and the fact we're pumping so many extra people into accelerating unemployment and housing crises and congestion. You know, maybe that's got something to do with it.
Hey, the one that kicked up a stink in the media this week, and I only just sort of caught it obliquely because I'll be quite honest with you, you had a weekend where I checked out, had the BFF down here for a few days, and I've been working some pretty crazy hours on the other life, you know, the day job as opposed to the side gig.
Yep.
So I haven't been as checked in as normal. And Hobson's Pledge have put a sort of, you know, we cat amongst the media lovey pigeons. I do love the fact that Herald did run that big full-page ad from Hobson's Choice. You know, you've got to love NZME, bless them. You know, private enterprise, they'll take that money where they can get it. And man, oh, there was some twisting of pigtails and squealing and hollering and wow.
Yeah, I saw old David Farrar of Kiwi Blog had said, oh, you know, the Māori Party being just like Donald Trump because he objected to some of the ads that Fox were running. It's like, no, David. No, if Trump was an ethno-nationalist who wanted laws favoring white folks and had paid the media to only run his message and then threatened to boycott the media if they ran anything that ran counter to what he wanted, then, you know, then he'd be being like Te Pāti Māori. But, yeah, we get it. You don't like Trump.
Mm.
The editorial in the Herald on Sunday, I know you saw that too.
Oh, God.
And again, this is the fawning. If you think about what I said earlier about the fawning response as you're reading this, understandably, Māori and non-Māori are expressing outrage and frustration over a coalition government that appears to target Māori deliberately, when what they're talking about is it's a coalition government that's saying, hey, let's not target Māori.
I know.
That's
well,
what it's about. They want to be targeted.
But then they even said that out loud. A little later on, the treaty's principle bill part of the Act Coalition Agreement with National seeks to redefine the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. While Act's interpretation focuses on equality, it does not consider equity. Like, yeah, equality gives each individual or group of people the same resources or opportunities. Equity recognises that each person is different, has different circumstances and allocates the exact resources and opportunities needed to reach an equal outcome. A group of licensed translators sent an open letter to the government early last month arguing that the bill was based on a translation of Te Tiriti that was deeply flawed and failed international translation ethical standards, because international translation ethical standards were so de rigueur in 1849.
Yes. Oh. Yeah, I was sort of saying 25% of Māori preventable death was from smoking, so abolishing smoking laws targeted Māori. It's the equity to protect people from the consequences of their own actions.
But that all rolls back round to self-agency. I got a tremendous amount of feedback from Lee's interview last week, Lee Taitua. He really resonated with so many of our listeners because he's wanting to take it back to having self-agency, to actually realise that Māori need to lift themselves out of the economic doldrums. And a lot of it needs to be themselves. A lot of it also needs to be looking at those resources and seeing what you can do. So his Pātaka Institute, if you visit his website, like he has one entire section there on how to actually create a CV, present yourself and go out and get a job. And I look at the stuff from Lipston and I'm thinking, you know, that's the sort of stuff you should be funding.
Yeah.
You know, another entire section on creating a garden and creating kai to feed your family.
I'd love to work on a social bonds system with Lee, and I might give him a call to that end. But, yeah, if you could turn up to a hapu and just say, look, we're not the government. Are you guys sick of losing yet? Are you sick of seeing your kids underperform? And are you sick of you know, thinking of yourselves as poor and bumping along in last place? Let's try some other things.
And we need to
people together some expertise.
And we need to get all Ronald Reagan on this. You know, we need to actually realise that the nine most dangerous words in the world is, hello, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, well, as I said, governments love anything that makes people demand less freedom and more government. So all these things that you think, oh, they're working hard to fix, suit them just fine. Prisons that don't reform, incompatible immigrants, fatherless kids, ineffective education, all creates work for the government.
Hmm. It was interesting. There must be going to be a survey coming out soon because I got a phone call to do a survey.
Yeah,
a medical survey.
Terrorizing some poor.
Oh, I know. Usually I would be like, no, thank you very much. Be quite polite. But I'd had a couple of Chardonnays, so I was feeling a little effusive. So I thought, oh, wow. I know. And the very nice man on the other end of the phone, Kevin, said to me, would you like to answer the three questions? And I went, oh, okay then. And he was like, oh, so I think he'd had a lot of rejections up until that point. So it was, you know, all the usual suspects. You know, who did you give your party to in the last election? What is the likelihood that you're going to a vote in the next election? Who do you think that might be? What would change your mind and the likelihood of you changing your mind on that decision? you know, yada, yada, yada. And then we got into, you had to sort of rate the different political parties, and you had which party represents this or that, you know, depending on what it might be. One of the things was what party represents best supporting the economy, for example. What is the party that best represents the supporting the environment? And things like that. The one that I loved was they get, as they're going down, he said, right, he said, what party do you believe has the best diversity? And I said, what? In terms of policy diversity? And he said, no, he said the party in itself, and that as a representative sample, is the most diverse. I don't care, Kevin. I really don't care. Is there an I don't care box? No. So should I just say you don't know? No, I know, Kevin. But there's no I don't care box. No.
Waving your empty glass at your husband?
To the BFF, actually, because he's looking at me through very narrowed eyes thinking, what mischief are you up to? And I said, well, okay, Kevin, is Te Pāti Māori on that list? Yes. Well, there you go. There's your answer, Te Pāti Māori. Not showing any diversity. Well, no, Kevin, because they're all Māori, Kevin, aren't they? Think about it. And he's like, and then finally we moved on more inane questions, and we get right to the demographic questions at the end. You know, are you married? Have you got dependent children in your home? What age group are you in? Blah, blah. And then he finally goes, and may I ask what gender you are? To which I responded,
after a long sip of wine.
Yeah. How many options do I have, Kevin? I know for me there are only two to pick from, but I want to know how many options you have at your end. Bless his little heart. Anyway, it was rather intriguing. I'll be interested to see if that crops out somewhere in the media somewhere. I see questions that I recognise. So, yeah, I don't think I was in the bell curve. Let's put it this way.
Well, you're right at the end of the right, probably. Hey, Thomas Coughlin, I thought there were a couple of accidental bits of truthiness seeped into the various papers. In the Saturday Herald, Thomas Coughlin wrote, good column, government risks being thwarted by race issues. He initially did the traditional thing and framed it as ACT being obsessed with race, rather than, as I said, they're sort of saying, hey, well, maybe race-based laws are kind of racist. He did actually give the view of a lot of Kiwis that you don't hear in the paper after, well, a condition of the Public Interest Journalism Fund is you had to frame things a certain way. But he said, ACT and New Zealand First have hit upon a real problem. There is the perception the current state of race relations has moved beyond its democratic mandate. Polling on issues like the Māori wards, the Māori Health Authority, co-governance and bilingual road signs showed only 19% to 37% of voters backed them, making them some of Labour's least popular policies. Labour behaved underhandedly in legislating them too. Its Māori wards legislation was not campaigned on and later rushed through Parliament. To this day, Labour has yet to offer a detailed explanation for its inclusion of hefty co-governance elements in its Three Waters reforms. You don't often hear that in the paper, do you?
Mm.
The problem isn't just the last government. The courts have frustrated many MPs past and present for what they perceive as an increasingly activist approach to Māori issues. Many in the legal fraternity argue those MPs are doing a poor job of reading their own legislation. Since the 70s, Māori have come to rely on the courts to have their back, correctly deducing that a majoritarian legislature was never likely to have their back. Māori realize that if this mandate extends to a radical redefining of the principles, it could curtail their ability to advance through the judicial system as they have done for nearly half a century. A significant phase in the history of the treaty will come to an end. So, yeah.
So here's the question that I have for you. Christopher Luxon maintained that in the coalition agreement that he would only agree, I think, what, up through the first reading for the Principles Treaty Bill, right? So why then, if the media and Māori hated it so much, why didn't they then just shut up, say nothing, don't create a stir, let David and ACT jump up and down and yell and do everything that they wanted to do, knowing full well it was going to be shelved anyway
because it was their sacred anger that got him to be that cowardly about it and exhibit that fawning response that I mentioned earlier. It's that combination of being a bit weak and driven by polls and how he's reported in the media, and also his inability to sell. So, I mean, you know, the elephant in the room is the majority of even Te Pāti Māori supporters don't want Māori seats on council. It's not a real popular policy, but there's this framing of it as anti-Māori. I mean, and celebration of the Māori seats being kept in Te Tairawhiti, Gisborne, which is 50% Māori. I mean, they should have no problem getting elected.
There are Māori who sit in general wards all the time and always have been in Gisborne. So exactly, yeah, that.
And they win. But, you know, there are cliques of people who, in as we well know, in that place and many others who are on maybe 20 different committees and boards and would rather be King Turd of Shit Hill than see any improvement that they can't claim credit for. And they've got a proud tradition, many of them, of achieving bugger all.
Well, my friend, I need to get moving. But thank you very much for your time. And remember, if you've got anybody out there has any comments on stuff that Marty and I have talked about today, 2057 is the text, and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. I'm going to do feedback very, very shortly, so don't disappear for that. But thank you, Marty, for your time again today, and we'll do it all again next week.
Thank you too, Marie, and thanks for all you do, and have a great week, everyone.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.